How to invent a religion.
I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job.
You can't stop what's coming.
Executive orders.
The creation and the maintenance of a secret government within our government.
Is something wrong?
The what?
With anything.
I feel like you won't stand by to rip your face off.
Is there something wrong with anything?
I was so spun.
What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
The law of the jungle, sir.
The most you ever lost in a coin toss? You don't know what you're talking about.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
I said, you don't know what you're talking about.
Suppression of unrest and dissent. Domestic anti-terrorism.
Don't have some way to put it. That's the way it is.
All right, it's Tuesday night. You know the ritual. Time for Blackball Roly Quaid right here on visionmedia.org. Got a very special guest tonight. We have the author of 11-9, no other than Philip Krast, and he's here for his first time.
Yes, here I am, Roly.
Let's start out with the main title, 11-9. Where did you come up with that particular title?
The funny thing is that the basic plot of the story is a false flag operation, as I believe 9-11 was, that provoked America into a war with in the Middle East. And in my story, it's to provoke America into a war with Iran. And the funny thing is that I started writing this book 7 years ago, and actually the last 3 or 4 years worked full-time on it. It went through a lot of changes. But anyways, I'm finally satisfied because at the end, as I say, 11-9 implies a terrorist drama, and the subtitle... And the terrorist who loved bonsai trees implies a comedy, and those are the two basic elements of the novel.
Would you say that Trudy's your protagonist of your novel? Would you give her that?
Well, I would say it has two. One, of course, is Trudy, this rather innocent young woman who is turned into a terrorist because she discovered this false flag operation, and they need to, the bad guys need to catch her. And on the other hand, there's the figure of Paul Klippen, who is this sort of affable diplomat who is not a sort of State Department robot, the neocon, although in different times in the book, he finds himself compelled to have to play that role and to sort of fake it. And so those are really the two sides of the story. One is Trudy, and the other is Paul Klippen.
Did you put your personality inside of Paul itself? Because I was debating whether you're Max or Paul. Did you take elements of your personality, your persona, and place it into your characters?
You know, that's kind of an interesting question. A friend of mine who read my previous book, in which Paul Klippen is the main character, this is a book that is set in Ecuador in South America, and because Paul Klippen has the same initials as me, Philip Krasky, he said, oh, that's got to be you. And the answer is that any character sort of starts as a little seed in real life. And Klippen, for example, is the name that I chose because he was a friend of mine back in college. And the person that I created really is not me. It's actually... quite a different person, a more conservative person than I am, a more intellectual person. But, you know, every character, because you have to go through his or her feelings, is a little part of you. And it's, but it's always a little frustrating when friends say, oh, no, that's got to be you in the story. And it's really not. It's really not me. The figure of the priest, for example, is an actual Jesuit priest that I knew many years ago. And he, yes, he really is the same person that I met in real life, a guy who was actually who was a sort of a espionage figure during World War II. He's a much older man, and but also a very religious man, rather sentimental, especially about women.
Priests are actually in particularly interesting intel personnel, because they hear the church's confession all the time, and it's very interesting to point that out. I was going to mention, and I was wondering particularly about Judy. I mean, Trudy, is she the type of woman to ever go incognito, to ever try to hide from anybody?
No, Trudy is a very straight up person, very much the same person inside as you see outside. She's a very solid person. But she's sort of been, not to spoil things too much for the reader, but she's sort of been compelled into this situation and has to fall back on her own resources. So it's a very unusual situation that she finds herself in. But she also has a very strong, courageous streak in her, which I particularly like.
Yeah, she's a survivor. I mean, at the core, I mean, given her day-to-day grind, the drudgery of the day, she seems to just adapt her background, but put her in a hardship. My goodness. She learns to adapt real quick.
Yeah.
Isn't that right, Philip?
Yeah, she was also a gymnast and quite a successful one. She went to Cornell on a scholarship, and her career ended when she had a bad fall on the balance beam, which is actually very very common among gymnasts. Gymnastics, by the way, has one of the highest rates of injury of any sport. And the balance beam is one big reason. It's a very dangerous sort of thing to work on. You see those women doing flips, backward flips on it, and boy, that takes a lot of cold blood to do that.
It actually takes, when your child is a toddler, almost 2 years to just learn how to do a cartwheel. It's very coordinated to do gymnastics itself. Even the Romans and the gladiators did gymnastics before their battles. You saw that in the movie 300. And it's interesting that she became a warrior straight out of gymnastics. I've made that connection
yeah.
when I was reading the book.
Yeah. But, you know, it's one of the things that when you write a character and you think about it a lot, because you spend years with these characters, you know, you begin to sort of understand them more deeply, and you understand their characters more deeply. And they really do become different people, not you. They become, you know, like your kids. They start out as part of you, and then they grow into their own person. And it's the same thing with characters in a book.
Did you make a crime lab with pictures and strings connecting people and trying to keep it all together? Or is your writing process you do all inside your head, or maybe take some notes?
It's all inside my head, actually. The only thing is that, especially with this book, I had a lot of trouble with the plot. And I had to keep changing the characters and so on. And when I take out a part that I'm not going to use, I just put it in this one file. And that file is about 150% the length of the present book of all the things that I took out. So it was quite a long process, very frustrating to keep changing the not knowing where I wanted to go with the book. And it's only finally in the last year that I wrote it that I finally had all the elements, characters, plot, everything all together.
This is the fifth book you've written, and do you feel that every book that you've written before, or even this one itself, you feel like it's a part of you, like it's an extension of yourself?
Yeah, you get to feel about your books when they're finally published and on paper. You get to feel about them as you do your children. It's not, of course, the same relationship, but it has that sort of feeling to it. It's something that's come out of you, and it's a very it's a very protective kind of feeling, which I suppose is why authors take it so badly when their works are criticized, and they go tooth and nail against their critics. So I don't do that, but other writers do.
I actually took a time capsule, and I've written between 200 and 300 articles, and I do feel that everything that I've written is an extension of myself. Part of like a diary of everything that's been going on in my life is what's going on in the news. But I took a time capsule and shoved it into it, and I actually took a picture of my avatar, and which is Torch from Puppet Master, and I put it in a time capsule, buried it, so future generations can see my favorite article that I've written, which was Frosty the Edward Snowden. Did you ever think about doing anything like that with your books? Like, figure out a way to preserve it for future generations?
Well, yeah, I intend to give away, a collection of my books to, for example, my daughter and now my grandchildren. She's had two children, and also like my nephews and things like that. And hopefully some years after I'm dead and gone, people might still read a chapter or two of my books. That's about as much as you get for immortality, unless by some chance 11-9 and The Terrorist Who Loved Bonsai Trees becomes a classic. That would be good for sales, so.
Netflix wants original material right now. That's the way they're shifting. And they've done it before. They did it a couple years ago. And I'm thinking, Philip, you could give them a sales pitch to make this into a 12-part series on Netflix. Have you ever considered doing that?
I don't really write drama and stuff like that. I wrote a screenplay of my first novel just as a normal movie, and tried to, get it shopped around Hollywood and so on, as thousands upon thousands of people do. Never got anywhere, and I haven't tried anything since. If somebody gave me an offer and wanted to buy the screen rights for it, I'd say fine. I don't know if I would participate in the writing. Maybe on a very general plane, looking over the scripts when they're finished. But as sort of an executive producer sort of a thing. But that kind of writing really doesn't do much for me. I prefer to work in prose on a page and everything.
Excellent. And you said that this was a comedy. Can you go into some of the funny aspects of your book without giving it away?
Let's see. Well, I'll tell you what. I'll read a little excerpt of the book. This is from the second chapter, where there's a hostage standoff. After these terrorists, which is in Chapter 2, they try to plant a bomb in the Empire State Building. They're caught, they flee, and they go to this one house, the house actually that Trudy just ran away from, where she was almost caught and taken prisoner. And these terrorists run inside, pursued by the police, and then they're in a hostage type of situation. Okay, so I'll just read a couple of paragraphs here, and you can get an idea of the sort of comedy that that I have in the book. Is that okay?
Absolutely. Go ahead and hit me with that, sir.
Okay. Here we go. The hostage standoff had begun, and from there, as everyone remembers, threats, bullhorns, telephone demands, panicked evacuations of surrounding houses, policemen crouching, reporters purring, tiptoes hurting, photographers squinting, seemingly, reportedly, apparently, allegedly, all the wet nurses of modern journalism rose to the task of covering a live crisis. SWAT teams unpacked lockers, special teams stretched muscles, local police chiefs sipped bad coffee, the White House expressed concern. Chin-stroking specialists from every fife and specialdom gathered at each end of the 100 block of Charles Drew Street, where a little carnival of professionalism crackled and hummed, all at the service of the public good and the extinction of public danger. And as the minutes ticked past, speculation spread its great white wings, soared, banked, wheeled, swooped, and glided on every network TV show in the land. Best bets were postulated, scary versions articulated, and worst-case scenarios despaired over. Newscasters echoed them, reporters tweeted them, and coffee mug-gripping experts formed panels to flesh them out. "They'll ask for a deal with the Israelis," said a CIA officer. "We do not negotiate with terrorists," said an ex-Marine commander. "The material objective is to make them see the hopelessness of their situation," said a hostage expert. "A surgical strike," recommended an Air Force pilot with AFPAC experience, though he admitted that collateral might be an issue for owners of nearby houses. A floor plan of the house was miraculously discovered, swiftly brought forward, and delicately analyzed. "Now I would imagine, Karen, that the hostages are being detained here in the kitchen at the back."
"But what if these men are hopeless, desperate to start with?" the anchorwoman objected. "I mean, what is the state of mind running through these guys' heads? And the scary thing is that this could happen on any American street. That is all of us in that house."
Any American street. Around the country, this melodic, wondrously dehiscent phrase burst and flung its seeds across the land. Any American street. Yours, mine, the newscasters, your best friends. Terrorists rife as termites could come running up to your house and firing a gun at breaking down your door. How was that, Raleigh?
That absolutely put a smile on my face. That was fantastic. Have you thought about making it into audiobook, like taking the time to sit and read it yourself? You could be the narrator.
I would love to do that. And if the book, has some success in sales and gets a little buzz, I would love to do that. I love doing narration. In fact, here in Spain, I do narration professionally and as sort of a sideline to my normal work, which is teaching English.
When I read it, I got my own interpretation, you know, of what was going on. And I was out of my seat, like, biting my nails. I didn't get the comedic aspect of it. Now I really get it. Absolutely fantastic. How did your book get published? Do you self-publish?
Yes, I self-published my book. All of my books are self-published, and actually by an excellent publisher, Encompass Editions, which is based in Ontario, Canada. One of the reasons is just that the rat race of trying to publish novels is really awful. You write to these literary agents, because, of course, publishers don't want to work with the unwashed writer. And these agents get thousands of letters every month. And, of course, you know, trying to fight against that kind of stream is almost impossible. And so anyways, I've always self-published my books. And the other reason is just that, you know, the publisher doesn't give you that much help in promoting your book. And also, what are publishers looking for? And the same as literary agents. They're looking for the next Hunger Games. They're looking for the next Harry Potter. And so if you come up with one novel, you know, written by you, not a famous person, you know, that they would have to promote and sell on and so forth, your chances are really awful. And so I've always self-published my books, not with great success in sales, but all right, with, you know, some, and people read them here and there, and I get good comments, and I've gotten good reviews of my books, and that's very gratifying to me. A guy asked me once, would you rather have $1 million for your book, or would you rather have 1 million readers? And I said, obviously 1 million readers. That's what I really like. I like connecting with people, telling them a story, and, you know, giving them something to think about. That's what it's all about. And, you know, the important thing is to get your book out there and get some people to read it. And that's, you know, even though I don't have tons of readers, the few that I have, like I say, it's very gratifying to know people are reading my work.
Well, you got me as one of your readers, and I'm a new reader, and I'm a big fan of your work, and it was an excellent read this week. Richard Thieme actually said the only way to tell truth is through fiction, and we see so many events in the world, like, for instance, Running Man, and we wonder if art is being imitated by the media and the government itself, and the only way to tell the truth is through fiction. Richard Thieme nailed it. And that's something that I've been thinking about personally, is writing fiction. There's something about the medium of writing fiction where people don't take it as serious, or they're not so closed-minded when you're writing fiction about reading your work, where if you write a book, they read the first three pages of the subject and then they're just done, you know. There's bias there. If I disagree with you, I'm not going to read your work. But if it's fiction, it's just for fun. It never really is just for fun. Nobody just writes a book just for fun. Yeah. There's always some sort of agenda, and they want to instill some sort of ideas that they have personally in their book and embed them in there. And that's what I want to do too. It's to propagate my worldview. And I was wondering, where do you get your ideas for your book before? Do you read 9/11 truth books, or go ahead and tell me some of the books that you like to read to get your ideas for your work.
For this book, yeah, I started reading books about 9/11 and the alternative theories of it, probably around 2006, 2007. And that's basically when I decided I wanted to write a book about it. And I'm glad that I did, because really in the fiction world, 9/11 is not much represented. I mean, the alternative theories of 9/11. And you're quite right about how fiction gets to truth. I mean, if you read a book by David Ray Griffin, you get a lot of information, okay? And you figure out how the whole thing was brought off and so on and so forth. And it's all fine and well. But in fiction, what you do is you synthesize rather than analyze. And so with fiction, you are dealing more with a general vision of say, 9/11, for example. And it doesn't give you information about 9/11, but it gives you a sort of a perspective on 9/11. You can call it truth, you can call it what you want, but it's a perspective on the whole thing put together. It's not information, it's a synthesis of the information. And the books that I read David Ray Griffin, Peter Dale Scott, one or two others. And that was a great deal on internet. Learned
Peter Dale Scott actually coined the phrase deep state, didn't he? That everybody's prescribing to now. His version of the deep state is a lot different than the way that Donald Trump describes it. But definitely Peter Dale Scott is a wealth of information. He's one of my favorite writers. Griffin is too. He took the 9/11 Commission report and absolutely shredded it verbatim, one page at a time, and leaving you with the conclusion that there was no shred of truth inside the 9/11 Commission in that 500-page cover-up.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, he's done a great service to his country and to understanding 9/11 in general. Absolutely, he and a lot of other people, Kevin Ryan, for example. That's the sort of analysis of 9/11, which is one side of getting the of understanding it. The other side of it is, I think, is fiction. And that's when you understand the whole thing together. For example, in my book, I have a vision of the deep state. I have the people who are affected. I have the false flag operation. I have the repercussions and the politics that go along with the American response to the attack and things like that. And you see the whole thing together, and it gives you a very different perspective on, say, 9/11, than just the information that you read from a book. So, as I say, fiction has a very important part to play in these things, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book. I felt that 9/11 had to have some representation in fiction.
Ever since I saw the movie 3 Days in Condor, I think it was actually 9 days in the book, I always look for fiction to try to steer me into some truth that's going on in the world today. Try to make sense of everything that's going on, because there's so many cobwebs in our head about what's going on, and try to straighten out what exactly is going on. There's so much information. Our intuition is built on crunching raw data that we see every day with our five senses. And if you're force-fed garbage every day, like tabloids and what Kim Kardashian's doing, you're in an infantile state of mind. It's going to take you in a state of mind where you'll believe anything. So when these false flags going on, immediately people just take it at face value, but they kind of have a Brazilian attitude towards it, and I'm referring to the film that was made in 1985, where it's just a part of life. Life goes on. And there's no emotional response whatsoever. It's just business as usual, status quo. And it's amazing that there's just a small thread of us that are actually worried about false flags and want some truth in this 1984 come true.
Also, or just understanding what 9/11 is in the larger sweep of history, and what its meaning is in history. For me, it's basically two things. First, 9/11 is part of the classic decline of empire that America is following. It's following the classic path of decline. And 9/11 marks the beginning, I think, of the drive for power of the military security sector. Now, in the decline of an empire, sort of the next to last step is plutocracy, which is where you have the government of the rich, which I think began mainly with Ronald Reagan. But with 9/11, you're beginning the last step, which is the taking of power by the military security sector. And that's what 9/11 is about in American history. And then the other part of 9/11 in history is the purpose behind it. A lot of people say, well, they wanted to, they didn't have an enemy with communism, and now they wanted to find another enemy. And I think that's true, but I think it sort of misses the point. The point of 9/11, the people who did it, I think what they wanted to do was completely change the conversation. I mean, before we had communism, and that was represented by the Soviet Union. But what is the Soviet Union? It's a country. It has a capital, a currency, a government, has borders. It has tangible things. But what is terrorism? Terrorism is a ghost. Terrorism is smoke and mirrors. I mean, it exists. It exists. But it's just a ghost. And you can say that anything is terrorism. Even these poor migrants who are coming up from Central America, you know, politicians are calling them terrorists, because that really, you know, resonates with the public. But with terrorism, you can expand much more the military security state, because it's, you know, you're shooting at a blob, you're shooting at smoke, so you have to expand enormously the military security state, and that's why we have the new Department of Homeland Security, which now, I guess, is the third largest department in the government. And that's what 9/11 is. It's the marks the decline and the last step to military, the military control of government, and it's also the changing of the conversation to terrorism. Although, of course, even if the military is in power, the forms of democracy will always be observed, just because they don't want to alarm people. But I think that's what 9/11 is.
And down at the border wall right now, the corporations are making a killing about the dilemma or the crisis itself. Whether you're pro or anti-border wall, you got to know that these agencies and this bureaucracy is absolutely raking in the cash with it. Even Trump met with a Sheldon Adelson to discuss making a casino down at the border. That's how really? Ridiculous it is. Yes. And it's amazing. You touched on what plutocracy is. Did you know that Pluto was the god of not only the underworld, of, you know, you could say crime, and also hidden treasure?
Huh.
So you got the underworld.
No, I didn't know that.
Yeah, and of course, the underworld, the mob, Trump, and hidden treasure. He has a lot of treasure hidden away. They even kicked out one of his hotels in Panama. they scratched off Trump off of it because he had so much hidden treasure in there. And he's the man to go to if you need to launder money, too. With his casinos. It's absolutely amazing that people don't connect the dots. It's like there's something wrong with them. And it seems that they're just absolutely just on a greased up pole in an endless hole, and having a conversation with them never goes to anywhere. And this whole QAnon thing, I don't know if it's reached a surface in Spain. It is, I'm going to use the word retarded, but I'm not using it as retarded, but like retarding the conversation, like slowing it down, like decreasing it. It's regressive, you know, this whole QAnon thing. I don't know if you've actually heard about it or not.
No, I haven't. QAnon, that doesn't ring a bell to me. Can you explain it a little bit, and maybe for listeners?
Yeah, absolutely. It was a trend that started on 4chan and 8chan. And there's this person that claims that he has Q clearance, which is a high level of clearance. And he has one of the largest bases of followers. He's actually bigger than Alex Jones right now. Alex Jones cannot mess with this guy at all. And nobody knows him. People think that he's a piece of mythology, that he doesn't exist. People think that he's multiple people. Some people think that they're part of Cyber Command and NSA because there's a Q group that really does exist. And there's also people that think that he's an Israeli control center and it's a group, or even Russian. You know, they have the GRU. It seems that we have a caller. We got Johnny from El Paso, Texas. Johnny, do you have a question for our guest tonight?
Hello, gentlemen. Yes, sir. Just in particular, when it comes to the Middle East relationships, I was just asking your guest as to what he believes is happening. There's a lot of things happening with Russia, Turkey, Iran. I was just curious as to what he thought about the foreign relationships on that.
Well, I think that Iran is being made a sort of a diversion and a scapegoat for all the problems that America has caused in the Middle East. As to Russia, I think they're trying to back up their ally, Syria, which I think is, a good thing to do. Russia and Syria have a relationship that goes back a long time. In fact, there's even a lot of intermarrying between Russians and Syrians over the years. And I also think that to some extent, Russia is a bit of a victim in all this. I don't think Putin is such a terrible leader. I think he's actually a very thoughtful person, and I think he's been vilified in the press because it's very convenient for them to keep a tangible villain on hand. But I'm sad that relations with Russia have deteriorated so much. I don't think it's Russia's fault. I think it's our own fault, the United States.
No, it's not Russia.
Hey, Johnny. Let me ask Philip a question real quick. So Iran has been put in this awkward position that it's being called the number one state sponsor of terrorism, and it hasn't attacked any nation in 200 years itself. And it's the final domino, according to Wesley Clark. And I don't know if you've read this part about Peter Dale Scott. Are you familiar with him talking about what's called the Safari Club, where he talks about three regional powers? What it is Iran, Israel, and Saudi Arabia all have a handshake agreement, and they're all part of what's called the Safari Club. And they're going to divide up the Middle East, where Israel gets Syria, Iraq, and gets Palestine, of course, and Saudi Arabia in the agreement gets Yemen, which they're bombing the hell out of right now, and gets Qatar, which they ostracize and cut off the border. And Saudi Arabia, you're not allowed to wear a Qatar soccer jersey, which is big in Saudi Arabia in the Middle East, and Oman. And that's where, like, Iran and, you know, the course of Hormuz, you know, all connect, right? They could shut down the whole oil market. So Saudi Arabia is going to get that. In return, Iran gets all the stand countries, because all those countries, they have Persian blood. For example, a matter of fact, Pakistanis, you know, are pretty much, they're ethnically diverse, but they all have Pakistani roots, the main tribes, at least, and Kurdistan, Uzbekistan. There's a lot of stan countries, if you look up on the map.
Yeah.
And they're going to get all that land, and even the landlocked countries that are not thriving whatsoever because they're landlocked. Like Afghanistan, there's only one city whatsoever. And it's rich of raw earth minerals that they're actually running out of in Afghanistan. You know, we've always heard about the poppy, but the things that we make, our cell phones, are actually running out in Afghanistan.
Lithium and cobalt in particular, yes. Yes, really. Lithium and cobalt in particular, yes.
But we'll steer the topic back to Philip's book. Johnny, have you heard about Philip's book at all?
I do apologize, gentlemen. I was going to listen to the beginning. I just caught it just in the last 30 minutes. I tuned in at 8:30, so I did miss the first 30 minutes. I do apologize. I was excited about your guest tonight, yes. I didn't hear about his book, no. Maybe you could inform me.
Would you like to camp out and you could chime in, probably be at the end? I want to touch back on his book. You did stay up.
I would be honored. Thank you. Yes. Continue. Proceed. Thank you. Yeah, I'd be honored. Thank you, Rolly.
Well, Johnny, if you look at Amazon and just put in Philip Kraske, K-R-A-S-K-E, you'll see the book there. So it's called 11-9 and the Terrorist Who Loved Bonsai Trees. As to Peter Dale Scott, he's a very well-informed man. I haven't heard about that theory, but, well, it's, one thing that could be investigated. One of the things that's very typical about this time in history, I think, is that, you know, there's never going to be a history, a proper history of this era ever written, even if on the rather dubious assumption that humanity is going to continue for another 200 years, because there's so much that's hidden and so much that has been squirreled away and will never come to light, and a lot of things that are important historical fact are simply going to disappear. Even a proper history of the Trump administration or Obama or the George W. Bush administration, I think it's very hard to read because so many of the decisions, so much of the key moments are hidden from the public and hidden from researchers. And it's a sad thing that really we don't know what's happening. And I think historians will never know the most important elements in history. 9/11 is what 9/11 is in history, that it marks the decline of America, the American Empire, and also that 9/11 completely changes the conversation, and it sort of plays right into the hands of the military security sector because, you know, the terrorism is just smoke and mirrors. It's whatever you want it to be. Anything can be a terrorist, and that's why it's the irony of this in my book of Trudy, who's this very sweet, nice, very religious young woman, gets turned into a terrorist in the media because the security services plant all these clues for them to find. And, of course, the media doesn't question anything that they're told by the security services, so it all happens very neatly.
Absolutely fascinating. In the Middle Ages, there was this call for we can't allow wizards to cast spell on us, and we need to cause a witch hunt and cast them all out and burn them at the stake. And it was a contrived thing. It didn't exist. And it's amazing that it became a witch hunt inside your book for Trudy, somebody who's just trying to work the 9-to-5 day and doesn't really want to be involved with anything that's dangerous, that all traces point to her. And she's somebody who doesn't get involved naturally, but through circumstances that have nothing to do with her, she gets pinpointed as a terrorist. And it really makes you believe that it could happen to anybody at any given time.
Oh, sure, sure.
With any stroke of luck.
Well, one of the parallels, I think, to that with 9/11 is that the airplane that went down in Shanksville, Pennsylvania, this airliner went down, and we are shown this sort of a smoking depression in the ground, and we are told that down below there's an entire airliner that has burrowed into the ground, which is so much nonsense, it's almost laughable. And but that's what people were told on 9/11, and that to this day is the official story. There was a whole airliner down there under the ground. And, you know, that obviously was a part of the story that went wrong on 9/11, and that was the best story that they could dig up. And but the media reported it, people swallowed it, even though it's absolutely absurd. An airliner doesn't hit the ground and burrow in. It breaks into a million pieces. But there it is. The media echoes these things and does it very well, very professionally. And there it is. Soon this myth hardens into history.
Flight 93 really did look like an abandoned coal mine, and they threw some tires on it and set them on fire, ablaze. And the picture of itself looks like they actually photoshopped in the tail. And that's the only remnants of the plane whatsoever. And there was actually grass growing inside of the burrow itself. Did you know that, Phil? That there was actually like signs.
No,
that,
I didn't know that.
There's actually signs
that's funny.
Hole existed for quite some time.
Yeah, that's a little bit like the intact windows to either side of the hole in the Pentagon. You know, it's just one of those things that kind of makes you scratch your head. So,
2006, the long-awaited Pentagon photos of the crash that took place on 9/11, and we barely saw anything, and there should be surveillance cameras all over the Pentagon that would actually capture every square footage of anything that's going on in the lawn. And we depended on a hotel and a gas station for footage, and all we saw was a quick flash and a ball of fire. And most people believe that well, we saw the Pentagon, there was no plane. There's a lot of scholars that believe that. Christopher Bolin, for an example. I think that Griffin actually endorses no plane in the Pentagon as well. And people were fine with that. But when you talk to them about Shanksville, they hit the wall. They go crazy.
Yeah.
You know, and if you talk to them about there is possibly a missile that hit the Twin Towers, and it was photoshopped in later on, the Phantom plane, flight 175, they think you're absolutely crazy. Like, the government would never CGI a plane going inside of a building, but they still have the idea that they would perpetrate a false flag on the American people and cause psychological warfare against the base, the taxpayers, to go into a war that's a 100-year war in the Middle East that I'm never going to see the end of it. Maybe my youngest brother, if he lives to be 100, because he was born in 2003, might see the end of it. But us, no, there's no way. Even my children don't remember 9/11 because they weren't alive. I got a Washington Post story that says a quarter of Americans do not remember 9/11 because they were too young. So 25% of Americans don't remember 9/11. And that story was written in 2015. And it's going up every year. People that saw what happened, you know, or what was reported during 9/11, they're dying off in droves, you know. People, baby boomers, you know, they're going to be gone soon. And that age of 60 and older, they're not going to be around to tell people what happened. And it's really disheartening to think that maybe there might be a false flag event even bigger than 9/11, or maybe it's not needed. People don't know what's going on, and they're ignorant, and they're unlettered. They don't read anything because they don't have time to, overwhelmed. And maybe they'll just go along with the idea of a perpetual state of war. What do you think is going to happen as far as the general consciousness of world affairs? I don't see any inroads where it's going to get any better. Do you, Phil?
Well, I guess in the first place, I think you're right. Especially in America, people are very ignorant of current events and things like that. And it's really pretty sad. However, you know, I live in Europe, I live in Spain, and people know a lot more of what's going on in the world. And one of the interesting things that's happening in world affairs is that Europeans are more and more skeptical of the United States, and especially with Trump, do not have the same respect that they had decades ago. And the result is that Europe is slowly drawing away from the United States. They're slowly developing their own defense system. They're making their own independent moves, like, for example, with regard to Iran. They're making their own independent moves that really anger the United States. But I think in Europe, because people understand what goes on in the world much more, there's much more of a sense that Europe has to defend itself and not depend on the United States, which has proven to be not dependable. That's one of the things that's happening. But yeah, I think you're right, Raleigh. It's a very sad sort of a situation in America. There's very little interest in current events, and even less in foreign affairs. People accept what they're told, if they even bother to inform themselves. And so the media here, the mainstream media, has all the power. It's slowly slipping. That's a good thing. But nonetheless, interest in foreign affairs is very low, and you know, always has been in America. So America fights wars, and life just goes on in America. It's just, you know, people are celebrating a booming economy, and everybody's making money, and everybody's happy. Well, okay. So much the better. But it's a country at war. It's hard to believe.
Absolutely. We've become a service economy that's totally geared towards war, the military-industrial complex. Matter of fact, when the Pentagon was being built and the spade was being touched on the ground for the groundbreaking ceremony, it was on September the 11th, 1943. Another side of the Potomac, there is Charles Lindbergh, who was protesting essentially that these new office space being built for the biggest world war, being built, and he was protesting essentially the New World Order. The same time, Leslie Grove was doing his groundbreaking ceremony, and they built the Pentagon with using less steel as possible to go to the war effort as much as possible. The Pentagon was built with concrete. Matter of fact, they get around with golf carts because they don't have stairs, and they don't, I think they do have stairs, but like they don't use like steel based anything as much as possible. And the elevators are raised with gurneys itself because they wanted it all to go to bullets and guns and tanks and war. During World War II.
That was a war in which people were really involved in the war effort. But since then, all the wars have been fought abroad and, you know, in places where people can hardly find them on the map. And that's one of the reasons Americans are so complacent about these endless wars. Although I think that that's going to change, especially if the United States starts a war with Iran, because Iran is going to fight back. And now that we live in, you know, a cyber society, I think that the possibility of cyber terrorism, well, a cyber attack by Iran is certainly possible. And then maybe that would really grab Americans by the scruff of the neck, and they would see what war is. That's, I think, a real possibility if there's another war.
Yeah, like in the media, they censored out dead soldiers coming back in coffins. When it was Cronkite, back in the days of Vietnam, you would actually see the impact of war. They really censored that out and just omitted the fact that we're at a state of war. And I think in Europe itself, people are not necessarily as anti-Iran as they are in America. I think it has to do with a lot about evangelicals inside of the country, where they're pastors who worship Jesus Christ, who is a pacifist, which is so ironic. It's ridiculous, the degrees of it. It's really a paradox that they teach the values of Jesus Christ and still want to go to a war with Iran, which is Israel's number one enemy, and it's in a lot of the lore inside of the Old Testament itself. And their arch enemy is the Iranians, the Persians. And I just don't see that Europe is so antagonized by Iran in the way that America is. I know that Iran has heavy influence with oil. They could cut off the supply of most of the oil. And America has been trying to sanction and get rid of Venezuela as well. I don't think that Europeans necessarily have it out for people from Venezuela. And that's another country that's going to be a hard war. It's going to be another Vietnam to have boots on the ground in Venezuela, because it is a jungle and they're willing to fight. The Iranians are willing to fight. They're not like the Arabs whatsoever. The landscape is different in Iran. And there's racial cohesion. There's a different mentality.
It's a very different culture, sure.
The Arabs are notorious for not having any unity inside the ranks of their military. And generally, when the bombs go off, they don't want to fight, you know, in uniform. They're more inclined to fight.
Arabs are very good. Rolly, just to correct you, Arabs are very good in rank. They follow rank, Arabs, actually. That's part of the drug.
You got to tell me which military you're talking about. If you're talking about the Syrians, yeah, I'd agree with you. If you're talking about like Hezbollah, which is a militia, I'd agree with
Hezbollah
is not a military, it's a militia.
But Arabics are pretty good at following rank is all I want to mention. I didn't mean to cut you off, but I agree with most of what you said, really. 99.9%.
Despite that fact, it's going to be a different war, and if altogether.
Yes, and it's coming to technology. Even Iran knows this. They even said this. Hassan, he even said this. He says it's all coming to communications within the Druj, Syrian port, Persian Gulf area. The Straits of Hormuz. Mm-hmm. The Straits of Hormuz. That's where they take over the oil tankers, two of the oil tankers. Iran already understands this. I'm just talking
It stung to high heaven as a psyop, though. It didn't seem like they really
could. It did, yes, you're right. It didn't make sense, yes, because they only had 12 crew members aboard of UK oil tanker. It made no sense. Yes. Hmm. It's almost like they wanted Iran to attack, to have reason.
They were actually over Iranian airspace, and they were being shadowed by an American spy vehicle. In order to egg it on, but Iran, you know, being the chess players that they are, you know, maybe being so connected to Russia, you know, they like to play chess. America, we like to play Texas Hold'em.
Russia backs Iran.
So what now?
I said Russia backs Iran. They support Iran.
Where did you hear me at any point in the conversation where I said they didn't?
I do apologize.
All right. Johnny, can you get off the line? I want to talk to Philip.
Oh, all right. Yeah. Well, thanks for taking the phone call. I do apologize.
Just one thing, Raleigh, to say. Europe, you're right. They're very skeptical of America's position on Iran. And even in Afghanistan and Iraq, they only... Europeans sent just sort of symbolic numbers of troops, and they were very restricted in what kind of action they could get into. And so Europeans, as I say, they're growing very skeptical of the United States and growing away from the United States.
That's absolutely sad. I know that there's... That's absolutely sad that the Europeans are moving away. There's a lot of anti-European sentiments inside of America itself. A lot of Americans who have been indoctrinated since birth believes that the ultra-wealthy in Europe are influencing it and causing globalism, and that's our roots, you know, Europe itself, and it's sad to see them distance themselves. There's a lot of discussion about Trump being an isolationist and, you know, America first. Inadvertently, by his attitude and his mannerisms, he is isolating America. He's making America look very childish itself. And
yeah.
I don't know what to do. If we impeach him, we get Mike Pence. Would that be any better?
Yeah. Well, Mike, at least Mike Pence wouldn't call the leader of another country Rocket Man and say a lot of very childish things like that. That's one of the things that has most turned Europe off. It's just the childishness of Trump. And if Americans can elect this guy, well, you know, what are they doing following the United States?
And then Pompeo wanted to buy Kim Jong-un a copy of Elton John's Rocket Man as a present to make up for the fight that they had during a Vietnam discussion. And Trump actually solicited to Kim Jong-un about making a reality show with him too. Worst of enemies, best of friends show. Did you catch that?
No, I didn't. I didn't see that. One of the real advantages of living in Europe is that you miss out on a lot of the sort of silly things that go on in America, and especially the media frenzy. That's one of the real pleasures of living here. So
you can't escape it. It's everywhere. You go to the gym. It's on the screen, beckoning you to watch it. You're at the pump. They have it at the pump for you to watch it. And the whole Mueller thing, the whole Mueller probe was a fishing expedition. It didn't go anywhere. It was a nothing burger. It was a total waste of time and energy listening to.
That's true.
It's amazing this error that it's always been that way. Probably with weapons of mass destruction. Iraq definitely has weapons of mass destruction, even Colin Powell hold up a vow in front of the UN. There should have been light bulbs going off in people's heads that that's a sign. Colin Powell's a terrorist. He's bringing anthrax. Jump him. Of course, it was an anthrax. And did you know that Mike Pence, actually, during that era, he was one of the people that was given anthrax that they intercepted and wasn't killed?
No, I didn't know that. He receives anthrax.
He did a press conference about it, and I got to send it to you. I'll send it to you via email after the show. And it seemed phony and fake and staged, his press release. Because if I was sent anthrax, I would be up the wall. I'd be scared. I would be worried about my children. And I might want to lay low for a while, especially this time of panic. And this panic is really embedded into your book, you know, this time of fear. Something that I've lost when I was a child, when I was in homeroom, and on 9/11, our school in a country town that I used to live with in, that was an hour away from Fort Bragg, and it was the first time we had TVs in school. And we watched 9/11 all day long in my homeroom class. All day long. We didn't have any school whatsoever. We just watched.
Is that right? That's interesting.
And that was the only time that we used TVs in my class.
You know, when I was a kid, the time that they brought TVs into class was during the Watergate hearings. And we got to see... which is really an education because you got to see how, you know, a Senate panel worked, how, you know, how they brought in witnesses, and the guy sits down on at a table in front of a whole panel, and he answers their questions, and that was really instructive to students, and I'm glad they did that. It's one of the first things that got me interested in politics was the Watergate scandal, because I was would have been 13 at that time, and yeah, that was really a sort of a game changer for me.
Did you ever hear the theory that the Watergate came about because Nixon and Henry Kissinger did not do enough for Israel in 1973? And it was a revenge?
No. I never heard that.
I think it was Peter Del Scott, a matter of fact.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
No, the understanding that I had of Watergate was that Nixon was particularly concerned about getting some documents back about how he had contacted North Vietnam and said that he would make a deal with North Vietnam if they didn't make a deal with Johnson, because Johnson was apparently by 68 closing in or getting closer to an agreement to end the war with North Vietnam, and Nixon got word to the North Vietnamese that he would give them a better deal. And what he was worried about in the Watergate break-ins was getting back those documents, which apparently he thought were in the Watergate Hotel. And that's why they broke in. So that's what I heard.
Did you hear about Nixon trying to break in and get into Daniel Ellsberg's psychological records in the psychiatrist's office in the Watergate too? Did you know
I've heard that, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever heard the name Douglas Valentine? He's a writer, and he wrote about Daniel Ellsberg, and it was in his book, 9/11, or CIA as Organized Crime. He actually wrote an interesting piece that became an article and part of his book, calling Daniel Ellsberg a drug dealer, and he actually stole a mob's wife away from him. And it gave me a different account, because Daniel Ellsberg took LSD and was connected to the MKUltra program as well. And Nixon knew that and was trying to blackmail him any way he could, because Ellsberg came out with the Pentagon Papers, which was damning to the war effort itself. It was a stack of papers that Daniel Ellsberg scanned off, and I don't know how many trips he had to take to get that into a briefcase. Is that what he did? He took it in a briefcase one by one, like segments of the document?
Yeah, something like that. He photocopied the whole thing. Yeah. I'm not sure exactly what it was, but I remember him talking about, well, the photocopier was the top of the line of technology back then, and so that's what he had to use. it's kind of a strange story in American politics. Raleigh, can I ask you a question? Just since you're a reader, in your experience, what are the best political thrillers that you've read? I mean, besides mine.
Best political thrillers. William S. Cohen, who is part of the Bill Clinton administration, I read, but I've been implanted so many more ideas in my head since then, where I forgot the crux of the book, but I wasn't reading it with eyes of trying to be entertained. I was actually trying to find information. So usually when I read a book, I look at a clinical point of view of, I don't want to be entertained. I'm trying to pull out sources for a show. And that's become
the crux of everything that I do. That's one of them. And I really like William Gibson. And
oh yeah,
You know, a lot of the books that he wrote about the dysphoria of New York, and he based his villains all mostly off of Donald Trump, which is ironic because he wrote a lot of them in the 1980s. And during the time, you know, Trump bankrupted New York, people would say. That's what people said. You know, not necessarily it was all him, but that was kind of the idea. And another writer I actually got my last name from was Philip K. Dick. That's one of my favorite fiction writers. There's the Total Recall, which was a short story that he wrote, We Will Sell Your Dreams Wholesale. And people call me Quaid all the time because they say my whole life is a conspiracy. But
that's a heck of a reputation to live down.
My dad actually named me Rolly, and it was based on Rolly Tyler, which was a protagonist of not a novel but an actual movie, which was Murdered by Illusion. FX, which this FX guy got hired by the DOJ to stage a mob hit because there was this mob head that wanted to get out of the business, the whole line of work. He wanted to retire, and he staged an assassination. And this is the time before CGI, and made it look like he died. I don't want to spoil the whole thing, but it was ironic that I stumbled across that and used Total Recall, because Total Recall was the last practical movie ever made with visual effects. Ever since then, it's all been CGI, you know, at some degree or another. And they had the same girl, the same actress, Rolly Tyler. And in the movie Total Recall, it's the half Puerto Rican woman that lives on Mars, you know, gypsy. And Philip K. Dick is a great author. He made, you know, Minority Report, talking about precogs. And that's going on right now. People in the tech business want to know your thoughts. Even that they're actually building that technology to scan and read what you're thinking. And Tesla is coming up with that with Elon Musk as we speak right now. And it's that indicator. Is fiction imitating reality, or reality imitating fiction?
Yeah. You know, with all these things about CGI and, you know, that they can take a sampling of your voice and then make you, you know, make you say sentences and things like that. And with digital photography, they can make it look like you're in bed with the Queen of England and so on and so forth. It sort of makes you wonder if any proof is going to be of a crime is going to be possible in the future, because the accused person can say, well, that's all just a faked recording. It's a faked picture. It's, but that's the way it's going. You know, I teach English here in Spain, and I work sometimes in, I give English classes in software companies, and it's really scary, you know, what you talk about with, you know, artificial intelligence, CGI, and you see these rows and rows and rows of computer programmers all working on different aspects of, you know, how to get people to buy, how to read their thoughts, looking at the different websites that people have looked at before they come to your website, where they might sell you something. And it's really quite a scary sort of a climate. And, you know, I've talked to some of these programmers about it, and they say, well, you know, that's the job they want me to do, and I need a job, and what else can I do? And it's really sort of a dilemma a lot of these people find themselves in, doing work that, especially as programmers, that they really don't agree with ethically, But they have to do it because that's what the company demands. And that's a real sad dilemma for a lot of people who want to, you know, do work that benefits society, of course. But yeah, that's one of the interesting things that I see as an English teacher. I teach English in a lot of different companies here in Spain. Right now I have, 7 or 8 companies where I go. I go to maybe 3 or 4 in a day. I give an hour here, an hour there, so on, 2 hours there, and so on. And it gets me into a lot of different companies, and I get to see a lot of different types of people and types of company culture and where, you know, how businesses are fighting for market or for survival and stuff like that. It's one of the good things about living here in Spain. It's in my work, I've really gotten to see a lot of how businesses work. It's really quite interesting.
The days of tribal warfare are over. It's now the corporate warfare. They talked about that in the movie Rollerballer, the 1974.
Yeah, that's right.
And they
that's
had
right,
the corporate.
James Bond, you're right.
They had the corporate anthem before the games. They stitched the American anthems yeah. and salutes, and it just became all corporate. And it's amazing. You're touching on the deep fakes. Did you know that during the Democratic debate, they actually took a zit and plastered it on Tulsi Gabbard's face, and she doesn't have a zit. They do dirty tricks like that.
They did a what?
They CGI'd a zit on Tulsi Gabbard's face. She does not have a zit. They were doing that with Ted Cruz, where like he had a piece of dead skin on his lip the whole time. And then he all of a sudden starts talking, and then he eats it.
Yeah, that's true. Or that recent thing they did to Nancy Pelosi, making her look like she was drunk or something, or, you know, slurring her words and all.
That actually prompted on C-SPAN, yeah. They actually had an intelligence investigation into that just because of that one little funny video making Nancy look drunk, slowing down her speech.
Yeah.
And if you get the gist of this 3-hour presentation on C-SPAN, it's the death of comedy. They want to make sure that you can't take a picture of, you know, that famous picture with Elvis Presley and Richard Nixon shaking hands when they met each other. People have been replacing it with like a different head of state, like Kim Jong-un shaking hands with Nixon. They want to get rid of that.
Because
they think that people are gullible, which they are. But you can't end comedy. I mean, come on. People got to laugh. If the world is going to go sour, where we're tearing each other up, Democrat versus Republican, can we at least laugh a little? Spread a little humor.
Yeah, that's for sure. Well, you know, it's one thing when somebody does it maliciously. It's another thing when, you know, some sort of program of satire, and it's very clear, it's made clear one way or another that what you're seeing is satire and not the real thing. It's not that hard to do, and as long as people do it, then I think it's all right. But you're right that CGI and all of these different technologies really make the truth harder to come by. And as I say, you know, it's the truth, and what the truth of 9/11 is, for example, I think a proper history of it is never going to be made, because there are so many aspects that will always remain buried.
Actually, in that particular C-SPAN 3-hour segment I was talking about, that was held on June 13, 2019. It was called the House Intelligence Committee on Deepfake Videos. And they must have nothing better to do than to wage war against deepfakes. But they didn't say anything or prompt anything that maybe CNN and Fox should not use CGI technology to mislead people. It's always the little guy. It's always the little guy with a little podcast that writes articles that they got to wage war against because they want to monopolize Fox and CNN. And most people don't get that they just play off each other. It's the official line is somewhere in the middle. And North Korea, they got one radio station for it that plays all day long, but you got to hear the propaganda. Here we're a little bit slyer in America, where it's the kind of a bounce off of in between each other. And I in some ways, I wish they would just be one unified state propaganda so we don't get these mind tricks and have to do mind jujitsu to figure out what's going on. And it's absolutely amazing. I don't know if you've heard of this thing called NewsGuard, which is an antivirus software to keep you away from fake news, what they call fake news, which is somebody who writes an article that doesn't come from the B-line. Somebody who doesn't come from clone from the ultra-liberal prototype and becomes a writer. And they want to put these in schools. That's the death of research. That must be very concerning for you that there's actually men and women that want to end research itself and just want you to rely on corporate media.
Yeah, that's true. I think you've got to dig a lot more deeply these days to do proper research. I mean, I remember when I first started getting interested in the alternative theories of 9/11, one of the things that I made a point to do was to look at the debunkers' point of view about, you know, what the truthers were saying. And that was really a good thing because I saw quickly that the truthers, a lot of their arguments were really not so strong. And in fact, you know, as much as truthers complain about debunkers, the debunkers of 9/11 have done a great service to the 9/11 alternative theory cause because they really made the truthers bear down and get every fact right, because anything they had wrong, you know, the debunkers were on top of it and saying that this proves that the whole argument is wrong. And so they really have made a better 9/11 truth movement that the debunkers have. And that's one reason that the 9/11 truth movement continues and is getting stronger, because they really did have to, you know, be clear and careful about every fact, every theory that they made, because they were going to be, you know, nailed on any inconsistency or wrong fact that they had.
I actually had a 9/11 debunker on my show called Adam Fitzgerald, which is a troll's troll. Like, he's the ultimate, like, famous debunker that everybody has scorn against.
Yeah.
So I let him say his grievances. He kind of does this thing where he tells you, I got information about 9/11 that you've never heard before, but I got to spend 2 hours to tell you it. So he strings you along and eggs you along, takes you a big road to nowhere, and then leaves you. Uh-huh. And he bans you from, like, Facebook, and then your email, he puts you in spam. It's absolutely amazing the dirty tricks that even like truthers use on each other. There is so many theories about 9/11, and there needs to be some sort of uniformity. Because if you have one dimension that's different than another 9/11 truther, they feel like they have the full package, that they actually have the doctrine written. It's divine law. It's gospel. You know, my theory is about 9/11. And if you touch on that one iota, you know, banish you.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that people that are not 9/11 truthers they're not necessarily debunkers. They don't really know that there's just so many theories that 9/11, there's points of contentions of it, and we duke it out all the time. And we waste a lot of energy on it. And there needs to be different mediums of it, of expression about 9/11. And you did it. You know, you did fiction. That is something that we need to take this creative energy and not drain each other and find different ways of expressing ourselves about what happened on 9/11.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's like I say, it's one of the reasons that I wrote the book. And I think that in particular, one of the things that I touch on is how public opinion and the perception of what's going on is so easily manipulated. Without spoiling anything, I'll say that towards the end of the book, the official version of what has happened with this terrorist attack on the Empire State Building and later on the hostage standoff and Trudy being called a terrorist, all of that has to take about a 180-degree turn and be retold in the media. But this entire process of remaking the official version of events comes off very smoothly, because it's all done very carefully with first a few leaks of the official investigation, then special prosecutors giving a few hints, and then a reporter gets an exclusive on some different aspect of it. And towards the end, the entire official version is remade, and nobody objects, and it all comes off very smoothly. Just as I say, with the airplane that went down in Shanksville, they told the story, and even though it's patently absurd that an airplane could burrow into the ground and disappear, everybody accepted it. And that's one of the nice things, the things that particularly is satisfying to me about the book, and that relates to 9/11, is how easy it is to manipulate the public if the story is told right and if it's done by professionals. And one of the things that I also talk about in the book is how these reporters, you know, everybody criticizes them and they're being told to say this and not say that. I don't think that's true at all. Reporters know instinctively what they're supposed to do, what they're supposed to say, how they're supposed to report, just by looking around at what happens at their television network or their newspaper, and they know how to handle a situation like 9/11. And I think it's, you know, really sad, but they are not going to risk their careers by saying anything that's, you know, off the beaten path. I'm sure that after 9/11, in the years afterwards, there were a lot of reporters who were quietly contacted by people who knew things about 9/11. And of course, the reporter listens to what these people say, and he thinks, oh my God, I've got a Pulitzer Prize here for the taking. And so he writes up the story, and he goes to his editor, and he says, look, I've got a guy who, whatever, he was there when they were putting the explosives in the building. He's one of the explosive experts. And the editor kind of rubs the back of his neck, and he says, yeah, it's really good, but, you know, this is really explosive stuff. I mean, this is revolution. If you want me to put this in the newspaper, you know, you got to come back to me with two other guys who were there, and they're all willing to go on the record in the newspaper and say this is what happened. And, of course, the story, ends up on the spike. It doesn't get out. And I would imagine that happened with a great number of stories about 9/11 that will just never be told.
Absolutely. Another prime example of that is Phil Donahue. He had an alternative interpretation about what happened on 9/11, and he was just written into the dustbin of history, just totally forgotten about. Never got never was a source again. Nobody, everybody just forgets about him. He's dead. You know, Hollywood blacklisted. Yeah. Media blacklisted.
Yeah, everybody. After years and years on television, I remember watching him on TV when I was a boy. And he said the wrong thing, and boom, he disappeared the next day. The same thing happened to Ed Asner with his program, Lou Grant. They had five successful seasons. Asner said the wrong thing in an interview. I don't remember what it was right now. It was something during the Reagan administration. And boom, his program was canceled. And, you know, you see that kind of censorship now happening on Facebook, YouTube, Google, and it's sad to see, but it's the same thing.
It was as if they just let YouTube happen unchecked for quite some time, and just so they could develop this deepfake technology so people would get on record saying certain things so they could have a voice recorder of you and do exactly what you described. They have you by the balls. I mean, like, for instance, there's this app that they have right now where you put your face on the app and they take a screen capture of you and show you how old you'll be in a couple of years. If you subscribe to that particular app, you actually sign away that the company has the rights to your face. Just to have this little app that they have for 30 seconds of entertainment, they have you. They have your identity, your face. There's nothing more precious than your face or anything to do with your body or yourself.
Yeah.
And people just don't realize that. They just are into self-deprecation and, like, totally into themselves.
Yeah, and imagine the humiliation, Raleigh, if, you know, you do this and you give away the rights to your face and they contact you the next day and they say, ooh, your face, you can have the rights back.
I watched so
that would
movie.
Probably that would probably depress a lot of people.
I just watched a movie recently. It's called Unfriend. There was a one that was called Unfriend that came out earlier. This one's Unfriend Dark Web. And there's a character on the show that does podcasts. And they're all conspiracy podcasts. And it's all the whole movie is on a laptop. So you're just seeing one person scream of a laptop. And what happened in this particular movie was somebody dialed in a threat and they took the sequences of his voice of things that he said in different videos and pulled out, you know, my name is, you know, where he did like the broadcast of his show. I'm going to take an AR-15 and shoot this place. And it was from a different recording, you know, like a Songify or something like that.
Uh-huh.
There's going to be hackers that can actually blackmail you in that way. I know for a fact, like pedophiles, like the child tracking services, so they know where your child is because they hack it. There's no technology that's going to be untampered with people that can do very horrible things with it. And if you got your voice, your face, and your location, you know, by satellite, there's a lot that can happen. And this whole idea of I could get a microchip that's big as a grain of sand in my arm, and I could buy all my currency, and nobody could rob me. It's so stupid because people can amputate you and use your card easy.
Yeah.
Do you really want to give them that incentive? Criminals are going nowhere.
Yeah. Well, it kind of makes you long for the days when you just had the local pickpocket who took your wallet, you know. At least it's just your wallet. It's not your arm. So.
Did you know that's where the Rothschild kids got their start with pickpocketing, like guys with pocket watches in the square, and they gave all that money to their mayor, Rothschild, and that's how they built the Rothschild empire, was through pickpocketing?
No, that's pretty good. That's pretty good. I have to be a little careful about that, though, because one of my former clients was the Rothschild Bank here in Madrid, Raleigh, so I got to walk a little delicately there, okay?
I'll actually tell you this later on. There was a particular PR group that did not like one of my articles, and truth be told, there was a mistake on it. You know, I messed up one of my articles. And they told me to cease and desist immediately or further actions will happen. And the article was about Rothschilds and Bitcoin. And my bad. I'm sorry, guys. I messed up.
Yeah.
But, yeah. So
yeah,
like,
with that kind of thing, you got to be pretty careful.
Yeah, definitely. And is there any more aspects of 9/11 that you would like to touch on? We have 10 minutes left of the show, and I will give you the floor.
Well, let's see. As I was saying about its part in history and about how in my book, you know, I don't deal directly with 9/11 at all. But I hope that when people read my book, they can apply some of its some of its ideas to 9/11 and what happened and what it means as a whole. Because in my book, I present the deep state, I present the truthers, I present the victims, the false flag operation itself, and I hope that it's a read that will not only entertain people, but will also give them something to think about. You know, Somerset Maugham, the great British writer, they asked him, what is a novel? And he said, a novel is a form of intelligent entertainment. And I think that really sums it all up. It's a work that appeals to your intelligence. I mean, if it's a novel worth reading, as many, of course, are not. And it's also entertainment. It's both things. And as opposed to, say, a movie, which basically has the objective of sort of blowing you away, of evoking a great passion. A novel is something that you read little by little. You sit down on the bus and read it while you're going to work. You sit down at night for a half hour, as I do most every night, and read with a lamp and a little glass of liqueur at my side. And it's a very civilized form of entertainment. And it has a lot of, I think it has much less bullshit, if it's a novel worth the name, because it doesn't try to lie to you by showing you a lot of special effects and this and that. Because at the end, what are you doing? You're sitting there looking at a page of print. And that's a very honest way of putting it. This is not real. It's just happening on print. And so there's no trickery. There's no cheating. There's no dishonesty. And so it's a form of entertainment that I have always particularly liked because it's honest. And it's an appeal of one person telling a story to another person listening to the story, reading the story. And that's what I like about it. So I hope that when you read it, you also had some sort of feeling of being appealed to as an intelligent human being, Raleigh.
I was off the chair. My nails were biting each chapter. I was wondering what's going to happen with the bonsai itself. And it's a very symbolic thing, the bonsai. I mean, that's like a symbol of Imperial Japan. And I was kind of wondering how are the Japanese are going to be tied in? Who knows else? The Russians, you know.
Yeah.
But we have.
One of the things that I sort of worried about is that bonsai trees, you know, the little tree in a pot which is actually what that means in Japanese. Bonsai is tree and pot. I was worried that people, you know, might not really be able to relate to that, because I've never seen much of bonsai trees in America, a few times, but it's much more popular in Europe, for one reason, because Europeans live in apartments, and if you want a tree like me, I live in an apartment, and I'm from Minnesota, so I've got to have trees around. You know, you've got to have bonsai trees, and so I'm a big bonsai fan myself. But I was sort of wondering if people in America understood what a bonsai tree was.
They have kiosks inside the malls in Minnesota with bonsais, but a lot of those businesses went under. I don't think it's really that popular. Every once in a while, you'll see the Zen gardening things where you take like a mini Zen garden and you scrape it around and try to get a therapeutic stress reliever. But I haven't really seen a lot of Asian culture inside of Minnesota besides the Hmong people, which they have their own mall, but I never see white people bringing any of that merchandise inside the house. So that's very interesting, too. But I was wondering, how did you hear about my show, Blackball?
Let me think. Actually, I've been trying to promote my book and doing radio programs, you know, interviews. I just looked up, for example, maybe Richard Gage, who is one of the big crusaders for 9/11 truth, and I looked up what shows he'd been interviewed on, just on internet, and I wrote to them. Very few, of course, have called me back or written me back. And so I'm quite grateful to you and your program, Raleigh, for giving me a chance to, you know, get my word out to the public. But that's about it. Just looking around to see where other people have been interviewed, who reviews books, stuff like that. Getting publicizing a novel, getting people to buy a novel is much more difficult than writing the book, I can tell you that. But that's basically the story. You probably had somebody on your show earlier who was connected with 9/11 Truth.
Ooh, I had Dr. Jim Fetzer on. I had Stephen Dayock. I had Dane Hartman. That's probably the three biggest 9/11 Truth researchers that I've actually had on my show before. But I reached out to numerous amounts of people. And it's amazing. When you build a platform, they will come. It's kind of like angels in the outfield, because there's not really that many platforms doing conspiracies nowadays. They used to be bigger 10 years ago. A lot of people are really inclined to just be part of a show because there's nothing else out there. And it is a chore to keep a podcast going. You know, you have to do it every week, regardless of you got the flu, shit hit the fan with your family, vacationing, all those things. Because if you miss 1 week, you know, you could lose viewers. Well, we do have Johnny. Johnny, do you want to ask our guest one more question before we wrap up the show?
Well, I would most definitely have the pleasure to. Thank you, Rolly. We've been talking about your guest, the relationships of 9/11 in the Middle East. All differences aside, what do you take from what's about to happen with the new relationships of Turkey, Iran? Obviously,
that's too much. That's too much for 3 minutes, Johnny. We're wrapping up the show.
Hold on, sir. Let me just fine tune this. My question is we already know about the conspiracies within 9/11. We're seeing now new relationships develop between Iran and Turkey. My only question is how do we see the new relationships happening in 9/11? That's my only question. And it's a broad question, but this is the main question that's been happening since 9/11. And most recently, we're seeing now new relationships within the Middle East. And my question would be is, how do we, what should we foresee as America's future, the Middle East future, within relationships of comrades, Iran in particular, Iraq? Obviously, this is how the Middle East war started since 9/11.
Well, I guess I just answer very simply, Johnny. I think it depends a great deal on two things. One, what happens with Saudi Arabia, and second, you know, in Yemen, and what happens with their internal power struggles, and two, what happens with the next president, because this president is not going to get much traction in the Middle East. The next president is going to have a heck of a job on his hands.
Yes, this may need to turn into another episode because I do have questions as to Benjamin Netanyahu in Israel. He did not win the elections, but that's a big part on foreign policies within the Middle East. So thank you for taking the time. Maybe you should be on soon, hopefully, and Rolly Quaid will take my phone call once again. But, yes, these are very dire times. I agree with you. Thanks for taking the call. I apologize, Rolly, for being a nuisance on your hands. But God bless you, all of you. I do apologize.
My pleasure, Johnny. No problem.
All right. Talk to you then, huh? God bless.
Yeah.
Philip, would you like to give a closing statement before we wrap up the show?
Closing statement. Well, it's just been a pleasure to talk to you, Raleigh. And again, I appreciate the chance to get out the word about my novel. And even if, you know, a person maybe takes a look at it on internet, puts it down, doesn't get it, I always appreciate that people take a look and give me the time for consideration. As I say, any reader that I get, I'm always really touched that somebody has taken the time to read my work. It's a great pleasure to me, even though I don't make much money out of my books.
It's definitely a great piece of art, and, you know, sometimes art is not very rewarding in terms of nickels and dimes, but I value your book. It's very well written. And I want to buy a hard copy of it, not just the Kindle version of it. And I would implore my entire audience, support him, support Philip's work. He spent a lot of time, 7 years, writing this particular book. And you even rewrote it one time, too. It had a rewrite to change the plot around a little bit.
Oh, yeah, and many times, yes.
Definitely support the guys that are working, that don't have necessarily a publisher and not in the big business, because if we don't support them, who else will? It needs to be the truth or community, and I definitely see grains of sand of salt, you know, shattered all over your book, and I'm trying to put all the puzzle pieces together, and it's going to take another read-through to catch it all, but I'm going to read the book as a comedy this time, and I'm even going to read it out loud. That's the best way to catch, you know, some of the nuances inside of a book, is really to read it out loud, to be honest. And it was a fantastic time that we shared and spent together. And I'm glad that you were on my show. And I'm crossing my fingers on my toes for this question. Will you be back on my show in the future?
Sure, I'd be glad to, Raleigh. Let me know when you want.
Yes, sir. Absolutely. And thank you so very, very much. And thank you, audience, for tuning in. And we'll be back next week with Brandon Green as my guest. And this is Blackballed with Rolly Quaid, and you were blackballed.
How to invent a religion.
I always knew you had to be willing to die to even do this job.
Can't stop coming.
Executive orders.
Creation and the maintenance of a secret government within our government.
It's wrong.
The what?
With anything.
I feel like you won't stand
by to rip your face off.
There's something wrong with anything.
I was so spun.
What's the most you ever lost in a coin toss?
the law of the jungle, sir.
The most you ever lost the contest. You don't know what you're talking about.
Don't say it. Don't say it.
I said, you don't know what you're talking about.
Suppression of unrest and dissent. Domestic anti-terrorism.
I don't have some way to put it. That's the way it is.